Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2006 and contained some strong language. The presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a writer and producer. His latest creation, The Thick of It, a television sitcom about politicians and spin, is currently walking off with prizes all over the place. It's remorseless parody of a government minister twisting and turning to the savage demands of the Prime Minister's enforcer is brilliantly performed and very funny. Before that, he turned his attention to the media and invented that archetype of modern comic heroes, Alan Partridge. Like all good comedy, his work succeeds because it's based on the shrewd observations of a serious mind. So it's no surprise to learn that he got a first-class degree from Oxford and spent 3 years writing a thesis on religious language with particular reference to Milton. But in the end, comedy beckoned because, as he says, it allows you to do anything. It can be as believable as you like, as mature or as silly, as intelligent or as daft. He is Armando Iannucci. To carry on with that quote, Armando, yes. You also say, as offensive or as safe. Undoubtedly, some people would find The Thick of It incredibly offensive because it's littered, as we know, with expletives and kind of male locker room humour.
Yes, I mean, I'm not naturally a swearer. And it's rather odd to be at the forefront of swearing technology.
But you believed it had to be there.
But I sort of
felt... do you have it on authority? I mean, is it authentic?
Yes, and the nicest endorsement it had was Sir Anthony Jay, who wrote Yes Minister, saw the first few programmes and on the Today programme said it has to have the swearing because otherwise it wouldn't be believable because isn't that's it? How it works nowadays.
And you've got an expletive advisor, I think.
Yes, there's a guy in called Ian Martin and he writes, not just the swearing, but he writes parts of The Thick of It, but he's very good at coming up with ever more inventive swearing phrases.
Like what? Can you repeat them here? I mean, people should know if not seen this thing. I mean, it really is extreme.
How are we going to do this? Because, you know, I'm now about to swear.
Yeah, well, try it and we'll cut it out if we don't like it.
Well, there's a knock on Malcolm Tucker's door. He's the spin doctor and he says, come the f*** in or f*** the f*** off. Now, I know now listeners will have just had a whole succession of pips, really, and
yes,
think it's 10 o'clock.
But they'll get the general impression if
yes,
they haven't seen it.
Yes.
But it is also incredibly funny in other ways. I mean, there's a great line, if you don't mind me quoting you, your hapless Minister for Social Affairs, Hugh Abbott, delivers in front of a select committee, doesn't he? He says, I categorically did not knowingly not tell the truth, even though unknowingly I might not have done.
Yes.
How hard do you work to come up with these?
Well,
do you hear them every day?
The thing is, it's so easy because it actually happens. And the day we were recording that scene in which Hugh says that happened also to be the day in which there was some case over whether or not Stephen Byers had lied to a select committee. And they ended up quoting back some of the phrases that he'd come up with. And they were not a million miles from that.
But at the other end of the spectrum, I was quoting you, I mean, from offensive to safe. I mean, Alan Partridge was always very safe, if you like. I mean, just insensitive, crass, ghastly, unlovable, but safe. You've said that he popped out fully formed. How did that happen?
Oh, right. It was when we were recording On the Hour. And On the Hour was a news parody. And I asked Steve Coogan if he could come up with a sports reporter. And he instantly came out with this voice, and instantly everyone in the room knew who this character was. We knew what his aspirations were, you know, what sort of a day he had. Somebody said, he's an Alan, and someone else said, yes, and a Partridge. And so even the name seems to have burst out fully formed. It was bizarre.
And he grew and grew, and he went into television knowing me, knowing you, and I'm Alan Partridge, and so on. But now you don't want anything to do with him ever again, I gather.
Well,
you've had enough of it.
Yes. The last series of I'm Alan Partridge took us about 18 months, and we spent about 8 quite intensive months writing it. And we write by slightly improvising. So Steve is Alan for those. And
all of the time, day in, day out, you're in the office with
him. And effectively, you feel you've worked for 8 months in the company of this idiot.
Yes.
And I just never want to hear him again, really. He's broken me.
Record number one. Tell me what that is.
Well, I'm absolutely besotted with Bach. And the first piece of Bach I got to know were the solo violin sonatas and partitas. And I always think of these violin sonatas and Petitas as a person, really, as a character. And the bit we're going to hear is actually a bit that we had at our wedding, so it'll remind me of that as well.
Third movement of Bach's Partita No. 3, played by Nathan Milstein. So it all began in radio for you, Armando, with, as we were saying, On the Hour, which became the day-to-day on television, with all those important bongs and reporters called, Rahan, whatever. Was it easier on television to make people laugh because you had the added help of the visual, all things visual?
I found it very difficult because as we were making the day-to-day, not only were we making the TV version of a show quite a lot of people had a lot of affection for, but we were also working out how to make television at the same time. So there were sort of two learning processes going on.
And so many people, because, I mean, you've got so many other things. You've got the props and the sets and the graphics. And so in a way, it moves away from you. You've got a whole
on radio, if you say, can I have an elephant, you actually do then have to go and get the sound effect of the elephant. Whereas if you happen over a cup of coffee in television to say, I wonder what it'd be like if there was an elephant. Before you know it, someone's gone and booked an elephant, even though you've changed your mind, you know. So there's a massive machine. It's like a super tanker when you're trying to turn it around. It does take about 5 days.
I'm going to ask you quickly one of those awful questions. Which do you prefer, radio or television, making programmes?
Do you know, I've never really decided. I mean, I do lots of radio still. And so, yeah, I sort of jump from one. In fact, I don't feel I have to decide.
No, you don't.
No.
I just thought I'd put you on the spot.
Well, there you go. That's the media trying to come up with some soundbite. That's soundbite culture for you, Sue.
But radio was always your first love. You were brought up on it, weren't you? And what did you listen to?
I listened to lots of radio comedy on Radio 4, and there was an awful lot of it on Radio 2 at the time as well. And, I listened to the News Quiz and Weekending and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which first started when I was about 14. I've still got the cassette tapes I recorded off-air, off-longwave. I can still hear on the tapes the time signal for Radio Albania sort of in the background, because you just picked up all sorts of interference.
But never a thought in your head. When you were working on your doctoral thesis on the language of Milton, you can never have thought you were going to end up producing Weekending and the News Quiz, can you? I mean, what a strange, you know...
Well, I wasn't.
Turning point in your life.
No, absolutely. It was bizarre when I became a radio producer. You know, the first thing, more or less, that I did was produce, quote unquote, Weekending and News Quiz, and find myself working with these people that I laughed to when I was 12 and 13 and 14.
But what did your mother think? She had this academic son, you know.
Yes, I think both my parents were assuming I would be like a doctor or a lawyer, or I think even when I went into comedy, I think my mum eventually thought I would go on to Panorama. I don't think she ever dreamt that I would hang around in comedy for so long.
Record number two.
Talking about my mum, actually, this is my mum's favourite piece of music. It's the overture to The Thieving Magpie by Rossini. And it would remind me of both my parents, really. We always had opera on in the background. It was always Verdi and Puccini. I slightly railed against it by liking Wagner, which they hated. But this would remind me of them.
part of the overture to Rossini's The Thieving Magpie, played by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by David Parry, which takes us back, Armando Iannucci, to your roots, to Glasgow. Mm-hmm. But the name, obviously, it's Italian.
It is, yes.
Glaswegian. What are its roots?
It's wholly Italian. My mother was born in Glasgow. Her parents came over from just outside Rome in about the 1920s. And my father was born just outside Naples, and he came over after the Second World War, stopping off on his way to America.
And I read that your father ran a pizza factory, also made kitchen furniture. Are both true?
Well, yes. No, he was very much... during the war, when he was about 15, 16, he took to the hills and joined the partisans. Then after the war, came over to Britain, ended up doing all sorts of odd jobs. But for the last 10 years or so of his life, he had this enormous pizza factory that had an extraordinary sort of Heath Robinson-esque machine that ran one length of the factory to the other, where you saw the dough going in at one end and then bits of mushrooms and peppers and so on being dropped onto it as it went along, and it being cooked as it went along and then falling off the other end. And it was an enormous contraption.
But I gather fortunes ebbed and flowed a bit while you were small. So, I mean, did you have to manage without a lot quite often?
Well, no. I mean, being self-employed, you know, there are ups and downs. And I do remember when there were downs, you know, we didn't regularly have a phone or a car or regularly go on holiday. But I didn't think that felt unusual.
But there were four of you, so, I mean, yes. It must have been a bit tight.
Yes, yes. No, I'm sure it was.
But
yeah.
Whatever else, you got a good education. They paid for your education. They felt very strongly about it.
Yes, and I remember my father in particular, it was his great sort of obsession, the way that, you know, knowledge was a wonderful thing and that education was a great thing and it must never be squandered.
And you were third in this pecking order of four, but you said my brothers, and you had two yes. brothers older than you and a sister younger, my brothers were much more normal than I was. I said, now, what does that mean?
You'd have to ask them. Well, you know, they went out and played football and cricket and, were very, very sporty and had Pink Floyd and Leonard Cohen and Lou Reed up and posters up on the walls. Whereas I went to the, you know, when the local library opened up around the corner, the Hillhead Library, I went and read books and took out classical music. So I must have looked, to them, I must have looked like an embarrassment. I was odd.
Number three.
Well, I after Bach, my other great love in music is Mahler, and when I joined this library and started taking out records, we were only allowed on the ticket, especially if you were under 14, you could only take two discs out. But the great thing about Mahler was his symphonies were so long that they were a double album in themselves, so it was sort of cheating. But I absolutely adored Mahler. It's very, very intensely romantic and passionate, but quite complex as well, and you know, his music has stayed with me since then.
Part of the first movement of Mahler's Ninth Symphony, performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Klaus Tennstedt. You set your sights, Armando, on getting into Oxford, didn't you? Which must have been quite unusual. What are we talking, late 70s, early 80s, Glasgow, for a young boy to want to go south was not what you did, was it?
Well, no. I mean, at the time, most people, if they went to university, went to the local university, went to Glasgow University or Strathclyde University. I suppose I was intensely academic, and I was drawn to the academic life, and so Oxford had an appeal, but I knew it was a bit of a long shot. But yes, in terms of the family, I mean, no one had moved away from home, no one had left Glasgow, so it was very unusual. I remember when I actually set off to Oxford, like all my family and relatives and everyone were all lined up at the Glasgow Central Station waving me off on the train. It was like, kind of, what on earth am I doing? What's happening here?
But, of course, it was an even bigger step because your father died, didn't he, just before you went?
Just about 2 months before I... And he, very suddenly, of a heart attack. And he had talked a lot about buying a little car and tooting down the motorway and coming to visit me. So, and I think, you know, because of his passion for education, it was something he was very pleased with, and it was just a shame that he never actually got to see me there. Mm.
But you got there, and it was, I gather, you thought, just wonderful.
It was great. It was fantastic, yes. And, which is why I couldn't really tear myself away from it. So when I'd finished my degree, I sort of hung around for another 3 years.
You also said it was almost too beautiful.
It was. Yes, it well, I suddenly, you know, I still felt a bit guilty, I suppose, because, you know, I knew that because my father just died, you know, I knew we weren't, you know, swimming in cash back in Glasgow. I knew it was quite tough. And then suddenly here I found myself in an environment where, you know, people had summer balls and... I remember in the first term going for a meal and it costing more than £20 and just feeling dreadful that I'd spent more than £20 on food. And I think I spent my first year or so just feeling slightly puritanical about the whole thing, just simply because of the contrast. And then I just thought, no, you enjoy it while it lasts.
And it lasted for 5 years.
Six years.
Mm. Next record.
Well, actually, being at Oxford was the first time I encountered, I suppose, the Anglican church service, and in particular Evensong, which I'm very, very fond of. And I really like the music, the church music of Herbert Howells. And that would remind me, I suppose, of my time at Oxford, but also just because I'm very, very fond of it as a sound. So this is a Nunc Dimittis from Herbert Howells.
Herbert Howell, Nunc Dimittis. The tenor was Roy Rashbrook, and it was sung by the Collegiate Singers. They were directed by Andrew Millinger, with Richard Morehouse on the organ. You say, Armando, that you play religious music at the beginning and end of every day on your desert island, would you?
Well, if stuck on the desert island, I could imagine starting the day with a Howell's Magnificat and ending with a Nunc Dimittis, just to give some sort of order to the day.
Are you still a practising Roman Catholic?
No, I'm a sort of lazy Catholic, really. I mean, I'm still interested. I was quite intensely religious as a boy.
You did think about becoming a priest, didn't you?
Yes, quite seriously for a while, and then realised, well, two things. One is, you know, this whole poverty, chastity and obedience thing. I mean, I can cope with the poverty, but really, the other two is not going to happen. And the other thing is, I made the mistake of actually reading the Bible. Now, the Old Testament, I know there'll be letters, but the Old Testament, God is a bit mad. That put me off a bit. And no one quite ever, to this day, has explained to me why Christ had to die for our sins. They tell me that he did, but no one has yet explained why. So I'm still drawn to reading about theology and spiritual writings and so on. But I've sort of settled on the notion that actually you never get to the bottom of all this. And that's part of the joy of it, really. You can spend your whole life mulling it over. You never arrive at an answer.
You'll be helped to get to the bottom of it now. You'll get a few letters, as you say.
I'm sure. They'll guide me.
But what kind of age are we talking about?
I must have been about 15, 16.
And your mum thought you might be a doctor. And yes. You thought you might go into the civil service. And you end up in Radio Scotland doing kind of spoofs on the news.
Yes, well, I was asked to present a radio show. They were looking for youth presenters, and I ended up presenting a live music show on Radio Scotland.
Pop music?
Pop, yes, you could call it pop. Well, I'd see it as indie rock.
But not what you liked, not what you played.
Not really. No, I boned up in it. I could tell you anything about the music between 1988 and 1989, really.
You should go on Mastermind. But did you feel in that moment the same as you'd felt when you first arrived in Oxford, that you were in the right place?
I felt absolutely at home, and it really came to me very, very quickly what I wanted to do. And they let me write some sketches every week and actually go off and make them. So it was a fantastic training course, really, in how to make radio comedy. And so I knew that that was it, that's what I should be doing.
Next piece of music.
Well, talking of comedy... I see what you've done here. You've woven these pieces very seamlessly. Very, very, very professional. It's a bit of Woody Allen. I mean, he's fantastic. He's my comedy hero. I love all his films. And I sort of felt I had to have the sound of people laughing, really, on this island. I know it back to front, but it still always makes me laugh. So I'd love to hear a bit of Woody Allen's early 1960s stand-up. Act.
I shot a moose once. I was hunting upstate New York, and I shot a moose, and I strap him onto the fender of my car, and I'm driving home along the West Side Highway. But what I didn't realize was that the bullet did not penetrate the moose. It just creased his scalp, knocking him unconscious. And I'm driving through the Holland Tunnel, and the moose woke up.
And it was Woody Allen and the Moose, recorded live in Washington in 1965. Your creations, Armando, have several things in common, many things in common, not just you. I mean, first of all, they're born of an obsession with the media, really, aren't they? I mean, whether it's news or sport or chat shows or political spin.
I suppose even the politicians in the thick of it are obsessed by the media. Yes, I hadn't really thought of that.
But it's born of anger, isn't it, the thick of it? It feels as if it is. I mean, how seriously deep do you feel?
Well, I suppose it was crystallised, you know, without getting dogmatic about it. I was very much against the war in Iraq. Thought it was going to be disastrous, and behold, it was. But it did make me think again about looking at how politics works today, and how we end up getting ourselves into positions which, you know, any Martian would tell us from outside are ridiculous. So I was interested in coming up with a show that plotted the process, really, where each episode would end with a ridiculous situation, but actually, you know, if you follow it all the way through, you could sort of see and understand why all the people got into that situation.
So it's heavy satire, really, as much as it is.
And I've always been very, very interested in politics, you know, from a young age, you know.
Might it become a politician?
I can't imagine, because I can't imagine having to nail all my colours to the one mast. I'd be the world's worst person to be spun, because I couldn't cope with it.
But we were talking about this obsession with the media, and certainly it's reflected in the way that you make the thick of it. It's sort of two cameras, isn't it? And you're just cutting and cutting. It's very fast.
It's very, very fast, and it's meant to be very
edgy
and nervous. I suppose I wanted to do it in a nervous way. And the cast, you know, there is a script, but they don't have much time to learn it. And in fact, I kind of encourage them to depart from the script. So that sort of slightly frightened look in Hugh Abbott's eyes...
is real.
..are also a frightened look in Chris Langham's eyes as he tries to think, what shall I say next?
But the greatest insult, I would imagine, is that Number 10 asked for a set of the recordings for Christmas, didn't they?
Yes, I know, that's depressing. But it may be that they asked for the recordings and then said that they didn't like it. In fact, someone in the Treasury said, I mean, we love it, but the guys at Number 10, they're all going, well, actually, you know, if we did leak a story, we'd leak it to the Evening Standard before the World at One, not after... So I'm glad it goes down like that in Number 10.
Number 6.
It's Cloud Busting by Kate Bush, which I first got to know when I first started going out with Rachel at university, and she, who's now my wife, she was a Kate Bush fan, and I first got to know Kate Bush. So it would remind me of Rachel, but also I really, you know, I really enjoy it as a song as well.
Like
That was Kate Bush and cloud busting. The other thing that your characters, Armando, it seems to me, have in common, if we're thinking about all the guys in the thick of it and Alan Partridge and so on, is that they're not at all lovable, like those people in sitcoms we've known before, you know, whether it's Only Fools and Horses or Terry and June. We feel no warmth for these people.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry about that. It's not a design. It's not grand design, really. Although you sort of tense up with Alan, I think you also slightly connect with him, I hope, in that a lot of people tell me, a lot of people say to me, oh, I know someone just like Alan. It's never them, you know. Mm. No one says, I'm just like Alan. But everyone always knows someone a bit like Alan.
But that's what I'm saying is that the nature? I mean, and you are now, what, the visiting Oxford professor of broadcast media, so you're supposed to analyse these things. You are this person for a year anyway. I mean, what it is, isn't it, that is the nature of 21st century comedy, and it's quite niche.
Yes.
In the way that all of the sitcoms that came before were mainstream. And that's not just because there are so many other ways in new media now of receiving programmes and so many more channels. It's also, isn't it, because that's where comedy's gone, into little cult corners.
Although I sort of think that maybe I think we have writers and performers now who are as good as John Cleese and Ronnie Barker. But I would argue that something like Father Ted, for example, which is a very positive, endearing, jolly, stupid sitcom, would have sat quite happily on BBC One about 15 years ago. It's up there with Blackadder. Mm. And I would argue also that I think the public are yearning for good, solid stuff.
I think that's right. I think they're hungry for it, but it's just not there. That's really my question. Why has it gone off into these little corners and niches, as we say, and how can you get it? What's the formula for getting it back?
Well, I think there's no magic formula other than telling people not to be scared of doing it. And I think people are scared of doing it because they worry if it's not successful, you've suddenly been not successful in front of a very large audience.
And that's where you're at, because you're Mr. Blue Skies thinker for the BBC now.
Oh, am
on
I
comedy,
really?
Anyway. I am told. Are you not, Armando?
Well, I've been sort of... I have this office in a place called the East Periphery Television Centre, and I'm allowed to develop ideas, but they're not... I mean, I don't have any automatic... nothing's going to get commissioned just because my name's at the end of it. You know, it still has, every idea has to go through the same procedure. But I've got a little bit more room to try stuff out and to try it out quietly so that when it is ready, it really is ready.
More music.
This is Sibelius. It's from his Fifth Symphony. Sibelius was one of those composers I came across where, I suppose, your conception, the sort of the traditional conception of classical music is of something being slightly precious, slightly effete. And Sibelius's music was the first music that sort of told me, actually, it can be really rugged and earthy and fascinating. The sounds you can get out of an orchestra are fascinating, and as fascinating as anything Pink Floyd has done. And this is my favourite Sibelius symphony, No. 5.
That was part of the final movement of Sibelius Symphony No. 5 in E-flat, played by the Iceland Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Petri Sakari. So what's next, Armando? Has your blue skies thinking yielded up anything yet?
Well, the next thing that I'm doing is a series called Time Trumpet, and it's a fake history show set in the future, set about 30 years time, looking back at events now. And you're sort of guided through it by a 70-year-old David Beckham and a 60-year-old Charlotte Church. And it is funny, you know, when a 70-year-old Tom Cruise walks into the room, you think, fantastic. And you do start believing it. It's great.
Time trumpet. In the meantime, it's life on a desert island.
Yes.
Does the prospect offer you joy or despair?
Well, a little bit of joy in that, you know, I can quite amiably live in isolation for a little while, doing a bit of thinking and a bit of reading and a bit of listening and so on. But I'm hopelessly impractical. Rachel says that she will come out on a boat and try and find me and bring me home. And she probably would, actually. She's very resourceful. I couldn't attempt anything approaching a hut or even trying to kill a fish. I'm not going to be very good at. So I don't hold out much hope, really.
Last record.
Last record is, well, it's Back to Bach. I love his cantatas. It's the most beautiful music I've heard. And it's both simple and charming yet playful at the same time. But anyway, I just, I'm rendered speechless by Bach, as you've discovered. But no, I love this.
Valet will ich dir geben, I take my leave of you, from Bach's cantata Christ is My Life, sung by Catherine Fuge with the English Baroque soloist conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. Now, Armando, if you could only take one of those eight records, which one would you take?
Well, I give it about a year on this island. And if Rachel hasn't rescued me, and I have every confidence she will, I think I will have to just, on the stroke of the end of the first year, I will have to build something and just sail off and see what happens. So I'll need something fairly stirring to be playing as I sail off, so I'm going to have the Marlon 9.
What about your book? You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, as you know.
I'd like to bring the collected short stories of H.G. Wells. They're fantastic. I mean, I love Wells's fiction anyway, but he's allowed to get away with a lot more in the short stories because he doesn't have to let it sustain for a whole novel. You know, with the sun beating down on me, me going off my head, I think the H.G. Wells will help me along the way.
And a luxury.
Well, I would like, and I would like you to make for me, because it doesn't exist, a virtual trifle. I love sherry trifle, but I know you're not allowed anything practical on this island. But if there was something that I could have which would give me the taste of a really good sherry trifle, but not the nutrition and the calorific value and all that sort of thing. So just give me the experience of a really good sherry trifle.
And a pot of glassy cherries.
Oh, yes. I mean, again, you know, I'm happy to have them virtual if I'm not around the real ones.
Armando Iannucci, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.